From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. U.S. stocks clawed back some of their losses this morning after yesterday's gut-turning rout on Wall Street. But it didn't last long. The major stock indices quickly lost steam despite news that the White House is considering an economic stimulus plan to stem the damage from the coronavirus outbreak. Let's bring in Scott Horsley, NPR's chief economics correspondent. And Scott, yesterday was the worst one-day drop on Wall Street since the 2008 financial crisis. What are you seeing today?
Well, the market tried to make up for some of those losses. It roared out of the gate the opening bell, and at one point the Dow Jones was up 945 points, so nearly half of what it lost yesterday. But as you say, the rally sort of lost steam late this morning, and at one point the Dow fell back into negative territory, down about 161 points. As of this moment, it is up. It's in positive territory, but the wild swings continue, so investors definitely want to pack their Dramamine.
Yeah, and it looked like investors were pleased by the White House floating a plan for an economic stimulus that would or could include a payroll tax cut and relief for some hourly workers who would be affected by this epidemic. What can you tell us about those plans, and does it look likely that Congress would be able to do anything about it?
Well, I can't tell you a whole lot. The White House has been very stingy with details of what they're proposing, but it does include a payroll tax cut, maybe some targeted help for airlines and cruise lines, which have been hammered by the coronavirus outbreak. They're also talking about maybe extending loans to small businesses whose operations are disrupted, and then that help for people who don't have sick leave. So if they do fall ill, they can take time off for work without, you know, economic pressure to feel like they have to go in to get a paycheck and possibly spread the virus around. The president is meeting today with Republican lawmakers, but there's been very little talk of meeting of the minds with Democrats on Capitol Hill. And, of course, Democrats do have the majority in the House. They're pretty negative on the idea of a payroll tax cut, but they might like that idea of helping people who don't have sick leave.
Big picture, over the last couple of days, what have we learned about the American economy? A lot of people are getting more and more worried about a recession.
There are some prominent forecasters who say that's now a possibility. Before the coronavirus outbreak, most forecasters were not anticipating a recession in 2020. You know, if there is a weakness to the economy, it may be that we do have so many workers who are living close to the edge that it doesn't take a whole lot to push them over, and this may sort of underscore that. This is also going to really be a test for the American political system to see if, you know, our divided system can respond to a threat like this. We're kind of watching for the answer to that in real time.
NPR's Scott Horsley, thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
And the number of confirmed cases of the coronavirus continues to rise in New York State. It is 142 at last count. And in New York City, people are being warned to limit physical contact and avoid big crowds. But as North Country Public Radio's Brian Mann reports, that advice is nearly impossible to follow.
It's morning rush hour in Midtown, and people race to catch their trains, jostling and bumping into each other. There's no social distance here. Caitlin McGuffin shrugs when I ask about safety.
Being in New York, you have to take the subway every day. There's really no way getting around it unless you want to walk 3 miles or so to work.
I hear this over and over. People are nervous, not sure exactly how dangerous coronavirus will be, but they don't have any choice. They dive in.
Today on the subway, like, the door is open and, like, people are so packed in that it can't really close.
That's Connor McKenna, who took the train from Queens. On a sunny spring-like morning, I find him up above ground already selling bread in the market at Union Square. He says his customers are tense.
Some people don't want bread, like, from up here. Like, they specifically request it from the back.
They're hoping for a loaf, he says, that hasn't been touched by other customers. A few stalls away, Lobsang Set 10 is selling honey and maple syrup. He, too, is trying to limit physical contact.
We are not giving up samples and stuff like that.
Are you worried at all about your own safety?
I guess everybody's worried about their own safety, but we just have to be very cautious. Just have to follow what people are saying, especially CDC. Keep on washing our hands.
He grins and holds up his little bottle of Purell like it's a talisman that will keep him safe.
Hand sanitizer every 30 minutes or so.
Gail Bilto stands in the next booth behind gorgeous buckets of cut flowers. She sells bright tulips and roses, and says she's trying to retrain herself not to lick her fingers before wrapping the blossoms in paper.
It's a bad habit, and I'm always doing it, so I'm trying not to.
She laughs, but Gail, too, says she's pretty nervous.
I'm almost 77 years old, so I am afraid for my own health.
Are you taking any extra precautions or doing anything differently?
Taking a lot more vitamins than I used to.
Companies and workers in the city are adjusting, trying to minimize risk. I find Corrine Fallon waiting for a train at Penn Station.
Our company actually has decided to take all unnecessary travel for the next 2 months has been banned. So just working remotely if you feel unsafe.
She decided it was worth it to make her trip to Philadelphia despite the risk. I asked Corrine if she's worried places like New York could see more serious travel restrictions implemented to fight the spread of coronavirus, like quarantines in China and Italy. She says she doesn't think it will get that serious here.
I think America is a lot more equipped to handle this in our medical facilities than in other locations.
A lot of people I talk to say increasingly they worry about the financial hit they could take from the coronavirus and its impact on the economy, almost more than they worry about getting sick. Brian Mann, NPR News, New York.
The sheer number of coronavirus cases in other countries like Italy and China is staggering. And a big reason we're seeing those numbers is because there's been robust testing for COVID-19. In South Korea, for instance, people have the option of getting tested through drive-through screening facilities. But here in the U.S., it's a different story. According to the Centers for Disease Control, as of today, there have been fewer than 9,000 specimens tested by CDC and public health labs since January. Joining us now is Crystal Watson, who is a senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. Crystal, welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks very much, Tanya.
So the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases estimated that this week about 4 million test kits will be delivered to labs across the country. That's after there were problems with the CDC tests. I'd like to know, is it clear how many people have been tested so far in the United States, and are those reliable numbers?
Yeah, so it's a moving target. We don't have a handle on all of the people who have been tested, but we do know the capacity for testing right now, which is about 16,000 tests per day, and that's increasing as we go along. So in addition to the CDC tests, state labs are doing testing, other private labs are doing testing. So it's hard to have a handle as this grows on the numbers of tests that are being done.
I'm just wondering, is it a setback in terms of containing the spread of the virus that there weren't enough tests available when the virus first appeared in this country?
Well, we really can't fight effectively what we can't see. So I think the delay in testing really did set us back. Fortunately, now we're catching up, but we have seen community spread of this virus now, and we are not sure how widespread that is at this point because we haven't been able to test enough people. So that makes it hard to roll out public health interventions that can help slow the spread.
Yeah. In addition to the actual test kits, also a big question, is there the public health infrastructure to speed through this process of testing and getting accurate information to doctors and patients?
Right. So the public health labs are doing a great job. They're getting done as many tests as they can at this point. And I think as we start to bring more other testing facilities online, this is going to expand our capacity greatly. So we have Quest and LabCorp that just started testing yesterday. And so that will be a big addition to the good work that public health is doing.
Can you give us a general description of how people are tested, how this test actually works?
Right. So when someone goes in to be tested, there are a number of ways that a doctor or a nurse could collect a sample. But I think the most common way is going to be through a throat swab. Then that swab will be sent to a laboratory, and that sample will be tested for genetic material from the virus.
You mentioned some of those private companies that now have their own tests. The Gates Foundation says it's developing a home test kit for coronavirus. Do you think that's helpful?
I think any way we can get testing out there is going to be helpful. Having tests that are sent through the mail may delay the results a little bit, but I do think that these innovative ways to test people is going to be a benefit going forward to help fight the coronavirus.
So I referenced South Korea had these drive-up tests. They were testing 10,000 people a day. Do you think that 10,000 people should be tested every day here in the United States?
Yes, I think at least that many should be tested. We have a big country here, and we have a lot of susceptible people. So we should be testing mildly symptomatic people in addition to those severely sick people who are in the hospitals.
Okay, because as it stands right now, what health officials are saying is that we can't really test you unless you have a fever, unless you actually come in with pretty severe symptoms.
Yeah, that's changing. So now we've heard from the White House level that we're going to be able to test mildly symptomatic cases, and we need to be doing that for the sake of those people so we can manage their care, but also for the sake of the larger public health effort to start slowing the spread of this disease.
That's Crystal Watson. She's a senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. Crystal, thank you so much.
Thanks very much, Tanya.
On a secret military recording, a sound so haunting, one scientist believed it could change the world.
My mind was racing as I listened to this, and I thought, this is the way.
Join NPR's Invisibilia for the first episode of our new season.
We're remembering McCoy Tyner, jazz piano great, who passed away last week. Tyner was born and raised in Philadelphia, and that's him playing My Favorite Things with another jazz legend, saxophone player John Coltrane, who also grew up in Philadelphia. Sadly, some of Philadelphia's jazz history is now in danger of disappearing, like the house where John Coltrane lived and where he kicked his heroin habit, which was a turning point for him. Let's hear more from Faye Anderson, director of All That Philly Jazz, a public history project. She also gives jazz tours in the city. Faye, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, Faye, your thoughts on the passing of McCoy Tyner.
Well, it's a loss. You know, he lived a long life, and that's what we must remember. McCoy Tyner represents the best of Philadelphia. He came out of the Philadelphia ecosystem that supported young artists. There's a story that over the weekend, Maxine Gordon, the wife of legendary tenor saxophonist Dexter Gordon, emailed me, and she said McCoy Tyner loved to tell the story of playing the piano in his mother's beauty shop. The piano was in the beauty shop because it was the largest room in the house, and the family lived above the shop. In fact, his Blues on the Corner is a tribute to his mother's beauty shop. It was on the corner in West Philly.
Tyner was a member of the John Coltrane Quartet, and Coltrane and Tyner are also closely linked in the history of jazz. Can you talk a little bit more about how Philadelphia shaped the both of them?
There was jazz everywhere, so there were opportunities to sit at the feet of the jazz legends of that day. That there was a place here, Heritage House, where concerts were provided, given for young people under 21, because if you were over 21, you had to go to a bar. So between sets, Ella Fitzgerald, Johnny Hodges, Chet Baker, they would come to this Heritage House, which is still there. It's now Freedom Theater. And they would offer concerts and a jazz workshop for children, again, under 21. The Philadelphia School District at that time had a very robust music program. It was everywhere. You can't overstate how much jazz was part of the Philadelphia life.
This year, the John Coltrane House was placed on Preservation Pennsylvania's list of at-risk sites. It's where he was living when he recorded his first big album, Blue Train. What does the Coltrane House look like now?
It's an eyesore. Not only was Coltrane living in that row house when he recorded, it's also where he was living when he met McCoy Tyner. He was fighting, kicking his drug habit by day, cold turkey, in the second floor bedroom. But at night, he had a gig at a club in West Philly, Red Rooster. That's where he met McCoy Tyner at Red Rooster. And so once they hooked up, they would practice at that house. So before McCoy Tyner's death, I would say that I am fighting to save this National Historic Landmark in the name of John Coltrane. I will now say I'm saving it in the name of John Coltrane and McCoy Tyner, because you cannot separate the two.
Yeah. You mentioned the Red Rooster. I'm thinking about some of those other jazz clubs where these greats played. Are they disappearing too?
Oh, they've disappeared. Most of the buildings are gone. So yeah, that's why it's so important that we preserve what few buildings are still standing.
I want to ask you, we also read about Music City, a space above a record shop, where another saxophone great, Philadelphia native Stan Getz, would play for fans. Here's Getz's signature warm sound on I Remember Clifford. What was Music City famous for?
Jam sessions. Young people could go there and hear. In addition to Stan Getz, you had Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie, Miles Davis.
Oh, wow.
They all held jam sessions there for the young people. The song you just played, I Remember Clifford, there are over 400 versions of I Remember Clifford. Clifford is referring to Clifford Brown, the young trumpeter who was up and coming. As it turns out, his last gig was at Music City. He was performing there, and he left there to go to a gig in Chicago. And he and his wife and another passenger were killed in a car accident. And so I Remember Clifford was composed by yet another Philly native, Benny Golson.
Yeah. You know, you talk so much about how jazz brought all of these greats together, and it's just part of the tapestry of Philadelphia. But there's also a complicated history here as well.
Absolutely. That in Philadelphia, as in other cities, jazz and the jazz culture was the first time whites and blacks mingled on an equal basis. And some folks did not like that. So you had clubs that were harassed by the police. One was shut down, the Downbeat. That we had the legendary Blue Note, another club that was harassed by the police, to the point where one night in December 1956, the Miles Davis Quintet was broadcasting live there on a Mutual radio broadcast. The police raided the joint that night, but the owner said, no, we saw what you did with the Downbeat. We are not closing down. And indeed, they remained open.
You know, I also want to ask you, you've written about the Green Book. For those who don't know, can you really explain more about what the Green Book was and how musicians really used it?
The Green Book was a lifesaver. It was a travel guide that empowered African Americans to navigate Jim Crow laws in the South and racial segregation in the North. The Green Book was published from 1936 to 1966, which coincides with the golden age of jazz. You'll hear about the Green Book and jazz musicians because they used it to identify places to stay, places to eat. Well, you know, when you think about the music that was created during that golden age of jazz, these musicians, music that we will listen to for generations to come, they didn't even know where they could sleep that night. It was horrible conditions under which they produced this beautiful music. So we have here a number of Green Book sites, six of which are still in the same business. But one is by far my favorite. It's the Club 421 in West Philly. That if you go there today, and I hope when your listeners come to Philadelphia, they would be able to sit in this same booth, at the same bar, walk up the same steps, stand on the same stage that Billie Holiday stood on, that John Coltrane stood on, Ella Fitzgerald. The interior has not changed since the 1940s.
Oh, wow. Faye, you mentioned Philadelphia-born jazz singer Billie Holiday. There's now a plaque honoring her outside of the hotel where she often lived. Here she is early in her career in 1935 singing What a Little Moonlight Can Do.
Ooh, what a little moonlight can do. Ooh, what a little moonlight can do.
You know, I'm thinking, Faye, we remember what a life in jazz did for some of these pioneers, but what a legacy they've also left.
Absolutely. And when you talk about Billie Holiday, it's not just her legacy as a singer. For me, as important is her legacy using her art to address the social issues of the day. And Billie Holiday certainly addressed those times with Strange Fruit.
Well, let's go out on another McCoy Tyner recording, When Sunny Gets Blue. Oh, so beautiful, but also haunting. Faye? Thank you so much for taking the time. I want to go on your tour now. I've got to visit Philly.
Please do.
Faye Anderson is director of the public history project, All That Philly Jazz.
The homeless population in America is one of the groups most in danger during this coronavirus outbreak. Many of them are already at greater risk because of inadequate hygiene and chronic medical conditions. Although there are no reports yet of coronavirus outbreaks in homeless camps, advocates are bracing for them. In California, Oakland's city council president is calling on the state and county to create washing stations so that homeless people can clean their hands. NPR's Eric Westervelt reports.
In King County, Washington, so far the center of the outbreak in the U.S., public health officials are bolstering sanitation practices and staff training at the region's established homeless shelters. Leo Flores is King County's Director of Community and Human Services.
And we are really focused right now on how do we equip folks to do that work that we know works to help prevent the spread, which is hygiene, cleaning, social distancing, and making, you know, smart decisions and having the resources to do those in the existing shelter network. We think that's one of our most important jobs right now.
Just in case, Floor says, the county has also set up space in modular trailers for homeless people who might test positive but have mild or moderate symptoms and need to recover in isolation, not a crowded shelter. The biggest challenge may be in California. There are more than 140,000 homeless in the state. Many are living on the street, making it harder for public health officials to take action. Dr. Peter Bielenson is director of Sacramento County's Department of Health Services.
It's number one, obviously, in terms of hygiene. It's much harder to follow the guidelines of washing your hands for 20 seconds when you don't have sinks around. And secondly, they're in a much more vulnerable population of chronic underlying health conditions. And so we're trying to make sure that we can protect them from potential infection.
Underscoring that latter point, Dr. Bielenson at first had workers in the field ask homeless people detailed questions about symptoms they might be having. But that plan was abandoned after so many homeless were reporting respiratory and other ailments from a wide variety of illnesses because of their rough living conditions. So part of Sacramento's new plan is to pass out hand sanitizer to as many homeless as possible as a substitute for hand washing. That is, if they can get a hold of some in time.
There's some real price gouging going on with hand sanitizers, with Amazon, for example, selling $8 an ounce when it's usually much, much less expensive. So
Wait, so Sacramento was going on Amazon to try to get bulk orders of sanitizer?
We tried to go on Amazon to get our bulk orders. We're actually getting our bulk orders from elsewhere, but it's going to take a couple weeks to get here. We'd like to get it more quickly.
Los Angeles County alone has nearly 60,000 homeless. Many live in makeshift encampments that are crowded and lack adequate sanitation, hand washing, and toilet facilities. So Dr. Jeffrey Klausner of UCLA's Medical School and Hospital was heartened when he recently visited one of several homeless camps under LA's 101 freeway and saw that city workers had set up a makeshift drinking fountain.
And that drinking fountain was attached to a fire hydrant, and right next to the drinking fountain was a bar of soap and a towel. So it can happen that the city can provide clean water and washing facilities. It's just not very widespread.
That kind of simple fix needs to become more widespread, Dr. Klausner says, if California and other states want to keep the virus from spreading to a population that, along with nursing homes, is among the most vulnerable. Eric Westervelt, NPR News.
It's primary election day in six states today, and perhaps the most watched state is Michigan, which has 125 delegates at stake. A win in this battleground state, which helped Donald Trump win the presidency 4 years ago, could be pivotal for both Democratic frontrunners Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders. Abigail Sinsky of WKAR reports.
In 2016, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders won Michigan's primary in a huge upset against Hillary Clinton. The weekend ahead of the Democratic primary that year, polls reported Clinton had a 25-point lead over Sanders before he won with a narrow victory. This past Sunday, at a rally with more than 7,000 people in Grand Rapids, he pleaded for their votes so he could pull off another upset.
2016, I won the state. And on Tuesday, if we stick together, if we bring our friends out to vote, we're going to win it again.
Sanders spent the weekend in Michigan, canceling rallies in Mississippi and Missouri to drum up enthusiasm in the state. But winning Michigan may prove to be more difficult this time around. According to the most recent poll from the Detroit Free Press, former Vice President Joe Biden has a 24-point lead over Sanders going into Tuesday. In the line outside of the Grand Rapids rally, Mike Farrell says he was initially an Amy Klobuchar supporter, but now he's trying to decide who he'll vote for on Tuesday.
I really like what Bernie has to say, but I'm a little worried about voter turnout for him. And I think the biggest priority at this point is getting Donald Trump out of the office. So.
Further down in line, Brandon Gregory says he'll be supporting Sanders for the second time. He's not worried about electability.
I feel like there's a big wave of people that are against him, and that's unfortunate. But I feel like if you listen to what he has to say, so many more people align with what he says compared to what other candidates in the race say, like Joe Biden, for instance.
Emily Carbonell Ferguson is one of those voters. She's wearing an Elizabeth Warren shirt. Warren was her first choice, but now she's going to vote for Sanders. She says she knows a lot of Warren supporters who haven't decided who they'll support now.
Honestly, if the debate were before the Michigan primary, I think that Biden would have a lot more to prove because I don't think he'll perform as well. But because there isn't that opportunity for like a big public speaking opportunity, like you can't compare.
A Sanders victory in Michigan depends on high youth turnout and steady turnout of white working class voters. A Biden victory depends on suburban, white working class, and black voter turnout. Matt Grossman, a political scientist at Michigan State University, says a path to a Michigan win will be difficult for Sanders.
If it's the case that Biden just has more indigenous support in rural areas and with white working class voters than Hillary Clinton did, which certainly is possible, then I think it'll be hard for Sanders. And then it shows that some of Sanders' support last time was really kind of an anti-Clinton vote rather than a pro-Sanders vote.
Across town in Grand Rapids, recently ousted candidate Amy Klobuchar is stumping for Joe Biden at a brewery in front of a crowd of about 250 people.
So we can have our own Super Tuesday in Michigan, just because it's just such a super big state. And we are going to do this, and we're going to do it. So I'm asking you, join me in supporting Joe Biden We're going to win this.
After Klobuchar finishes rallying the crowd, Carl Kelly says he would vote for either Democratic candidate.
I think he just has a better chance of beating Trump. It's not that I like Biden any more than I like Sanders, but I just think he has a better chance of winning the election.
Outside, waiting in line, Colleen Burns agrees with Kelly.
There's a lot of people that that I know, too, that actually are Republicans that have been on the fence, and they would not, you know, have crossed the fence for Bernie, but they definitely will for Joe.
Going into today's primary, many Democrats in Michigan agree on only one thing, according to Kelly. They'll support whoever gets the Democratic nomination.
Absolutely. My saying is vote blue no matter who.
For Here and Now, I'm Abigail Sensky.
To Twitter now, CEO Jack Dorsey has reached a deal this week with activist investors who had been pushing for him to step down. But Dorsey's days at the helm of Twitter may still be numbered. Let's bring in Casey Newton. He's the Silicon Valley editor for The Verge and joins us now from San Francisco. Hey, Casey.
Hey there.
So Dorsey has been targeted by investor Elliott Management, which is considered an activist investor, as I mentioned. Who are they and why did they apparently want Dorsey out?
Well, they're sometimes called the most feared investor in the world because they have such a good track record at getting what they want. They famously fought a 15-year battle against Argentina to get Argentina to pay back some debts, and they won that case and made a tidy profit. You know, when it comes to Twitter, I think like a lot of investors, they noticed that the stock just seemed to be underperforming. If you looked at some of the other social networks, their stocks had been up something like, you know, 100% or more in the case of Facebook over the past 5 years, while Twitter's was actually down, user growth wasn't very good. And Jack Dorsey has been CEO that whole time. So they came in and they said, hey, if you don't make some changes around here, we think Jack Dorsey needs to go.
Well, what changed the investors' minds? Why did they reverse course on this campaign to push out Dorsey?
Well, it's amazing how fast they changed their minds. They only wrote their initial letter to Dorsey something like 5 business days before Twitter capitulated. But what Twitter agreed to do in the near term was to bring on 2 of their chosen board members. So Twitter's board is expanding to include those 2 new members, and it will include a 3rd new independent director at some point down the line. Twitter also agreed to spend $2 billion buying back its own stock, which will presumably caused the stock price to go up, and that will address another one of the investors' concerns.
Okay, all of these changes made, but you write that Jack Dorsey brought himself more time as Twitter CEO, but it may not matter. Do you think he'll still be ousted in the future?
Well, they've given him some very aggressive goals to hit as part of a kind of performance improvement plan. He needs to grow Twitter's user base by 20% this year. He needs to accelerate the rate at which revenue is growing. And as fears over a pandemic spread and the stock market continues to take a hit, that could be very, very difficult to do. So I do think that there's a very good chance that by the end of the year, Dorsey will not have been able to hit the metrics that the investors have demanded, and that could once again put him on the chopping block.
I want to ask you about something else. Twitter is also in the news today. This week, the company implemented its new manipulated media tag for the first time, and it was used to mark an edited video of Joe Biden that was tweeted by White House Director of Social Media Dan Scavino and retweeted by our president. Twitter said the video was deliberately misleading. What is the significance of that?
So this big question as these tools to edit videos have become sort of more democratized is what do we do when one of those videos goes viral, right? Maybe it's had some pauses edited into it or the clips are taken out of order to sort of suggest something that the person in the video didn't actually intend. And historically, social networks have not wanted to touch this subject at all. But as criticism has come in that they are essentially aiding in the spread of misinformation, over time, they become more willing to take action. And so Twitter this year said that in cases like this, it was going to put on a label to these videos denoting the fact that they'd been manipulated. And for the first time, they actually did it. And I do think it's a big deal. You know, I like to say that policy is what you actually enforce. And there was some question about whether Twitter would actually be willing to slap a label on something that had the president's endorsement. But they did. And now the question has sort of been, well, you know, is it effective or not at actually reining in misinformation?
Yeah, I mean, that is the big question of the day. Will it make any difference in stopping the spread of false or misleading information online? I mean, do you think we'll start to see more videos being tagged?
Yeah, I do. And I think that there's going to be more debates over how should we design those labels. You know, Facebook famously, when they started putting on labels that said, hey, this news story is false, it actually made people share them more. So Facebook started to say this has been disputed. And I think we're going to see a similar evolution on Twitter as they try to see what works the best.
That's Casey Newton, Silicon Valley editor for The Verge. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
At the port of Oakland today, more people are being escorted off the Grand Princess cruise ship and into federal quarantine after several passengers tested positive for the coronavirus. And now the Trump administration is warning some people to stay away from the ships completely. Here's Dr. Anthony Fauci, head of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, at a White House briefing last night.
Personally, I would never go on a cruise ship because I don't like cruises. But that's another story. But the fact is that if you have the conditions that I've been speaking about over and over again to this group, namely an individual who has an underlying condition, particularly an elderly person that has underlying condition, I would recommend strongly that they do not go on a cruise ship.
Taylor Dolvin covers the tourism industry for the Miami Herald. Taylor, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And Princess Cruises is based there in Miami, cruising a big business there in South Florida. How's all this negative attention going over there?
We haven't seen a tangible impact yet, but it's safe to say that the companies are sort of scrambling to figure out how best to address this. They are expected to present new safety protocols to the White House, ramping up everything from pre-boarding screening with temperature checks to solidifying their quarantine protocols if this does happen again. So we're waiting to hear about that today.
And meanwhile, are people still getting on ships there at the Port of Miami? I mean, are they going on cruises?
Yes, I was out at the port yesterday morning, and there were thousands of people boarding cruise ships there. One woman even told me that she bought her cruise ticket within the last month and took advantage of some of the unprecedented deals that are being offered.
Is this a financial decision that people are making? Like, they don't want to be out the money that they spent, or they want to get a deal? I mean, are they just not afraid of being sick?
I think it's both things. The cruise companies have adjusted their postponement policies, so in most cases you are able to reschedule your cruise for a later date. But a lot of people say, look, I took the days off already with my job. I've been planning this for months. I met a couple yesterday who was boarding, planning to get getting married on the ship and had 70 relatives and friends with them, and they said, you know, we're not going anywhere. We've been working on this for a year.
So that's the passengers. What about the people who are working on these ships? What are you hearing from them?
I talked to several cruise ship workers at Port Miami yesterday, and they're feeling scared, and they're also feeling really closed off from information about what's happening. They say that sanitation on ships has been stepped up. They're being encouraged to wash their hands really thoroughly and wipe down surfaces in their cabins. But they're definitely nervous and feel out of the loop.
And aren't some of those dock workers the ones who've recently gotten sick in Florida?
Yes, we have 4 total cases so far in Broward County, and 3 of those are workers at the port. To be clear, these aren't workers on board cruise ships. They provide services like bag handling and greeting actually at the port.
And what's the status of some of the ships that are out there right now in the ocean? I understand there have been a few other coronavirus scares.
Yes. So we had a ship off the coast of Florida on Saturday that had 2 crew members from the Grand Princess ship in California that had transferred here to Florida a few weeks ago. And they were tested. Both of those cases came back negative, and that ship was eventually allowed to dock. And then we currently have another ship where we're awaiting test results for 2 additional crew members on the Caribbean Princess ship. But that ship has had to skip its last Caribbean island visit and is now headed straight back to U.S. waters to be held offshore until we get those results.
The State Department over the weekend released a travel advisory essentially telling people to avoid going on cruises if you're elderly. The Trump administration is considering putting restrictions on cruising. You mentioned this. It looks like the cruise industry is trying to get ahead of it. At the same time, the White House is floating the idea of bailing out the industry with financial support. What are you hearing about that? Do you expect that the cruise companies will eventually need that?
My colleagues in Washington, D.C. reported exactly that yesterday, that and from what I can tell, most of that is coming from President Trump himself. They interviewed several Republican lawmakers who said it's too early to talk about that, and one even said sort of no way. But it's important to remember that the estimate is that 150,000 people here in South Florida work for these companies. So our economy is extremely dependent on this industry, and it is a huge economic support here. I think it's too soon to tell if that bailout will play out, but it'll be interesting to watch in the coming days.
Well, plus it's political, isn't it? I mean, I'm sure that industry carries a lot of clout in Florida, and elections are coming up.
Yes, they make campaign contributions just like any other big corporation. But it's also important to remember they're extremely profitable, these companies. Carnival Corporation is the largest cruise company in the world based here in Miami, and it had a net income of $3 billion in 2019. So the risk of these companies going out of business, I would say, is slim.
That's Taylor Dalvin. She covers the tourism industry for the Miami Herald. Taylor, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dell.
I'm Tani Mosley. This is Here and Now.
In a new memoir, Men in Black filmmaker Barry Sonnenfeld says his neurotic personality has been good for his career.
It has given me a quirky attitude towards life and towards movies. You know, the movies I tend to do are all about lighthearted, dark issues.
That's next time on Here and Now.